Summer has officially come to an end. While the long hot days are wrapping up, there's still a lot of summer to fall produce to get through. One of the staples that can be a little baffling for home cooks is the eggplant. Purple, sometimes white. Confusing texture as foods go, and a flavor that's a little hard to describe. Eggplant, when cooked bad, is a strange vegetable to encounter. When it's cooked well, it can be a real treat. On this week's edition of Food Friday, our guest has been tackling eggplant dishes. She's got some recipes to share. Deb Perlman is creator of the popular Smitten Kitchen blog. Her most recent cookbook is called Smitten Kitchen Every Day, Triumphant and Unfussy New Favorites. Deb, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me on again.
Now, are you an eggplant fan, Deb, or from way back, or a recent convert?
I'm more of a recent convert,
yeah,
actually.
Me too.
We didn't eat it that much growing up.
Nope.
I think either my dad or my mom wasn't terribly into it, or they hadn't been raised with it. And it's crazy to me because it's a staple of cuisine in so many parts of the world. And now I get it.
And it's very possible I've learned the hard way to cook eggplant wrong, right? Like, I've cooked bad eggplant in my life, I will admit.
I feel like the worst eggplant is the undercooked eggplant.
Yeah.
Like, the worst thing you want to feel, it's not one of these vegetables that's good al dente. I mean, maybe some chef is pulling it off, but it's definitely not me. So I feel like you need to let it cook. It has to be fully cooked.
Now, you've got some great recipes for us, but I want to just get into some basic techniques. What are some of the basic ways we can make good eggplant?
The easiest way is to let the eggplant be what it wants to be, which is a very soft vegetable. I think it's sort of nice not to fight it. I mean, you can roast it and you can grill it and you can fry it. You can do all sorts of things to get it sort of crispy, but it's usually kind of short-lived. You're kind of fighting a little bit. So I feel like when you have things like baba ganoush or a sauce made out of eggplant or a dip, you're kind of just letting the eggplant do what it's eventually going to do anyway. And then the opposite of that is like to bread it and fry it, as you might with like an eggplant parmesan. And that definitely stays crisp, but it's also quite a bit of work.
And I've learned to accept the mushiness, as you're encouraging us to do. Like, I will oven roast it. Actually, the thing I've been doing lately, I cut like about a half inch circles of eggplant, toss it in oil, vinegar, and spices, give it a good long bake. And it gets kind of mushy. And I don't try to make it crispy. I might get a little bit of caramelization on it. And once you're ready for that texture, it could come out pretty good.
I feel like that's definitely the case. And I also feel like if you really want something I love to do with baba ganoush or muda bal, we need to get into both. But the one where you smoke and char the eggplant and you mix it with tahini and garlic and it's so good. But, you know, it's not a crispy thing. Obviously, it's not something for texture. But if you want something with texture in it, you can top it with crunchy things. You can top it with pita chips or some diced up cucumber that you've lightly pickled. You could add some nuts to it. So there's so many things you can do to add texture without trying to make the eggplant something that it is not.
Let eggplant be eggplant.
Exactly.
Let's get into that dip a little more. Now, you've shared a handful of recipes with us. We have them at WPR.org/Food Friday, this smoky eggplant dip. This is kind of like a Middle Eastern theme of flavors and textures going on here.
Yeah, so it's basically what we mostly call baba ganoush, but I had my mind blown when I did this recipe a few years ago to learn that baba ganoush is just generally what we mostly call it, but it's actually, and I might be pronouncing it wrong, so I'm cringing over here in my studio, but muda bal. And what I learned is that baba ganoush traditionally has onion and tomatoes and no tahini in it. And what we think of as baba ganoush is actually muda bal. Anyway, the fact is that even in Syrian and Levantine and Egyptian restaurants, you often see muda bal called baba ganoush, mostly because that's what everybody calls it anyway. So we don't need to split hairs over that. I'm going to call it baba ganoush. And I love it. I mean, I absolutely love it. I love it with a lot of tahini and garlic, and I like to use it. It's just such a fun thing to do with eggplant. And I always thought that if you didn't have like hot coals to smoke your eggplant over, it was never going to taste okay. And I was pretty happy to learn that I could char an eggplant over a gas flame in my oven or under the broiler and then roast it the rest of the way. It's not going to be as exciting of a flavor as you would get over charcoals or whatever. But if you don't have that in your, say, small New York City apartment kitchen, it was nice to be able to achieve that flavor. And then from there, I love putting things on top of it to kind of make it more of a full meal. Like I mentioned, diced cucumbers or making pita chips, or maybe you crisp up some chickpeas or you add some diced tomatoes. But to try to like make it almost a fixings type thing.
And then what do you have handy? So you've got pitas. You could put it on, I don't know, falafel or chicken things. Like, this dip is going to be pretty flexible whether or not you put crunchy stuff on top of it.
Exactly. I just mean if you miss the crunch or you like the contrast, mm-hmm. which I think makes food delicious, there's a lot of ways you can play with it. But I think just a bowl of baba ganoush and a lot of pita wedges is always going to be a popular thing at the end of the summer.
Well, now, a lot of times you'll say to somebody eggplant and they'll finish your sentence, Parmesan. And you write on your blog, you're not necessarily a fan because you're trying to make it crispy and then making it mushy again by Parmesaning it. But you found a stuffed eggplant Parmesan that you do like.
I did. And I saw it on Pinterest and I saw it on this recipe website called The Kitchen. And I loved this idea because when you make eggplant Parmesan, and I've done it. I mean, I've done it from scratch, and you slice the eggplant, and maybe you salt it, maybe you don't, and you roll it in flour, and then you dip it in egg, and you roll it in breadcrumbs, and then you fry it, then you drain it, you salt it, then you make sauce, and you layer it in a casserole with all this cheese, and then you bake it. Wait, we're not done yet. It's so many steps, and I think I was ungluing my, like, feet from the floor in the kitchen. I'd made such a mess for, like, 2 days. Maybe I should learn to clean up better. And then I saw this recipe where you basically just – it's like a stuffed vegetable. You scoop out the eggplant. You chop up the filling. And you add some onion and garlic and flavors. And I ended up adding some crumbled sausage to it because I wanted to make it a little more protein-centric. And then you cook it in some sauce. And you finish it with cheese and a little bit of breadcrumbs. So you get the crunch, but you also have this dish that you could actually make on a weekday night without a lot of steps.
Talking to Deb Perlman right now from Smitten Kitchen, cooking with eggplant on this week's edition of Food Friday. Find that recipe for a stuffed eggplant Parmesan and others at WPR.org/Food Friday. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite eggplant dish? Are you intimidated by cooking with eggplant? Do you have questions? Have you had success? What do you want to share with us? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. Smitten Kitchen's Deb Perlman is with us, helping us cook with eggplant. Let's go to our callers at 800-642-1234. Don is with us in Iron River. Don, hi.
Hello.
What do you got for us, Don?
I grew up in an Italian family, and I had no idea what I was eating until I looked in a cookbook about 30 years ago. Sicilian caponata.
Mmm.
And what is that, Don?
It's so good.
Well, it's with eggplant, and it's with zucchini and onion and peppers and vinegar and sugar and tomato and basil.
All right, Don, thanks for that call. And Deb, sounds like you know what this is more than I do.
I love it. It's almost like, and I feel like this word's going to go over weird, but it's almost like a sweet sour eggplant jam. It's more savory than sweet, but it has like a real hit of vinegar in it. And it's so, I do have a recipe for it on my internet website, Smitten Kitchen. I'm like, have I promoted it enough? Sorry. So I have a recipe for it and I love making it. It's such a nice late summer thing. And I actually love putting it on a sandwich with a slice of mozzarella. That's kind of like my happy place.
Oh, okay. I think I've seen that. They sell it in jars sometimes, like at an Italian deli or something.
Absolutely. But like sometimes they can go a little mild on it, and I feel like you really want it to be a little bit vinegary. Like it should be a little bit shocking.
Nice. Thank you so much for sharing that with us, Don. Let's go to Fulvio in Milwaukee. Fulvio, hi.
Hi. I'm right here. Good evening.
Hi. What did you want to tell us about? Yep. Go for it, Fulvio. What did you want to tell us about?
Okay, eggplant. You know, eggplant is such a weird vegetable. Either love it or hate it. But, you know, if you treat it well and if you do it well, it can be a very pleasant thing. And there is a dish in Italy, it's called Norma, Pasta alla Norma, which mostly is indicated with penne pasta. And you can cut the eggplant in like finger and size.
Uh-huh.
And use a lot of garlic, saute the garlic, and then you cook the eggplants, and then you put diced tomatoes in it.
Ooh.
And, you know, the tomatoes, they bring out that juice. And then you can serve it with the penne.
That sounds great, Fulvio. Thank you so much for sharing that. Another Italian recipe there, Deb.
I love pasta alla Norma. It's like a, you know, I'm probably going to say it wrong, but it's like a nice garlicky tomato sauce with either chunks of roasted or more often fried eggplant in it. But the eggplant is allowed to be itself, which is to say that it's a little bit softened, but it still preserves its shape. And it's a very hearty pasta, and I really enjoy it.
Fulvio, thank you so much for calling in and sharing that with us. Let's take one more caller before we go to maybe another recipe or two. Wanda is with us in Orfordville. Wanda, hi.
Hi. I really don't use eggplant because I do from my garden, and the eggplants usually produce 2 eggs at best, so the yield for the space is not great. However, tomatoes yield a ton of tomatoes that can't ripen when the frost comes along in Wisconsin. Green tomatoes work just like eggplant.
Okay, interesting. Oh, Wanda, thanks for that call. Now, I don't know if there's a huge market, Deb, for people who are like, they want eggplant so bad right now and they can't find it and they need a substitute. But if they're in a position like Wanda in their garden, maybe they do.
It's so interesting because we have a little patio and I try to grow tomatoes, and it's too hot in New York in the mm-hmm. summer. It's almost too hot. My little tomatoes kind of I know other people do it successfully, so no doubt it's my skill and not like tomatoes in the weather. But it's so interesting when I hear from people in other parts of the country where it just never gets hot enough for the tomatoes.
Thank you so much, Wanda. Good luck growing eggplants next year. Let's check out another one of the recipes you shared with us. Speaking of pasta, we heard some pasta a minute ago. Rigatoni with eggplant puree. Now, this is using eggplant as a sauce kind of formation here.
This is such a great, like, you should make this for dinner tonight recipe.
Oh, that good. Okay.
So it uses the ingredients that you have in this pasta alla norma, but you basically roast everything together, like the tomatoes, the eggplant, and the garlic, and with nice seasoning, and then you actually blend it into a sauce for the pasta. So it's a smooth sauce, and it sounds a little odd, but it's so good. I feel like it's such a sleeper hit of a recipe, because obviously the pasta sauce is going to be like a little purpley. So it has an interesting color, but you know, you throw some basil on there and like some nice white cheese on top. And it's a really nice, cozy, hearty dish. And it's probably even easier to make than pasta alla norma, where you normally have to fry the eggplant slices.
Is this the one where I wrote on your blog that you read the first time you made it, you thought you overblended it and said, hey, now let's just pulse this a few times?
Yeah, I might not. I probably shouldn't have used like a grocery store eggplant in January. I mean, shockingly, it was not the best specimen. Because I went back a few years later. A friend told me, she told me that it's one of the recipes she makes the most often from the site. I'm like, that one? Really? So I went back and I made it again. And I was like, this is amazing. What was my problem? It doesn't need. Yeah, no, it's absolutely great. And especially with seasonal eggplant, which is perfect right now.
All right, we'll set the eggplant aside. What's the next ingredient you're looking forward to cook with this time of year, Deb?
Well, I just made an apple cake today, so
nice.
I guess we're kind of getting into that, but I sort of tiptoe towards it. It's going to be only apples for a very long time, so they're fun at first, but like at some point in January, you're like, huh, cool, apples again, eh?
Yeah, well, I've made my first apple crisp, and yesterday I made a apple bread pudding during the first half of the Packer game. The pudding came out better than the game.
Really good. So do you do – okay, so your apple crisp, are you a crisp with oats and nuts type person, or are you going like more crumbly?
Oats, yes, no nuts.
Okay. That sounds delicious.
I liked it.
Oh, I haven't made that in way too long.
Well, let's talk apples sometime, Deb. We're all out of time, but thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks.
That's a lot of fun. That's Deb Perlman of Smitten Kitchen. You can check out her blog of that name. She's been at it for over a decade now. Her most recent cookbook is Smitten Kitchen Every Day, Triumphant and Unfussy New Favorites. She joined us on Food Friday to talk about cooking with eggplant. Find a few of her recipes at WPR.org/Food Friday. We're going to check in now again on the major national story that's been developing over the week and just the last few days we've seen. A formal impeachment inquiry announced by House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, the contents of a whistleblower complaint about the Trump administration, public testimony by the acting director of national intelligence, and notes on phone communication between President Trump and the Ukrainian president. Both the whistleblower complaint and the rough transcript of a July phone call between Trump and President Zelensky mention the U.S. president asking his counterpart to help investigate former vice president and possible 2020 rival Joe Biden and his son Hunter. Lowell Barrington is an associate professor and chair of the political science department at Marquette University. Lowell, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob. It's good to be back.
Well, I want to start with some of the basics that we seem to know pretty rock solid from the rough transcript from the whistleblower, in some ways from the president, this idea that, yes, President Trump talked to President Zelensky and seemed to be trying to rally him to look to reopen an investigation of the president's potential campaign opponent. How important is that one detail?
I think it's important in particular because the place that he first asks for the favor comes immediately after President Zelensky had brought up the issue of military aid from the United States to Ukraine, which really makes it appear as if the favor is very connected to that topic of U.S. aid to Ukraine. So I think alone that's an important issue. It's clearly important because he is asking for favors connected to American elections, both in some ways the 2016 election, but also looking ahead to 2020 and Biden as a possible opponent of his. So for both those reasons, it's a very important conversation itself, just alone. But obviously the way that the transcript has been handled and then with the whistleblower complaint details coming out, it is sort of expanded to a bigger topic now.
I want to give a listen to President Trump talking. Here he was in a press conference with Ukraine President Volodymyr Zelensky. They spoke together at the UN this week. Here's a listen to President Trump.
And I really hope that Russia, because I really believe that President Putin would like to do something, I really hope that you and President Putin get together and can solve your problem. That would be a tremendous achievement. And I know you're trying to do that.
So a lot of people saw this, Lowell, as an awkward moment. Can you talk about Russia and Ukraine and the parts of Ukraine that Russia is currently holding on to?
Sure. And this is, we could have a very long discussion about the long history and relations between Ukraine and Russia historically. But the main area of time that this starts really kicking in for our purposes is in 2013-14, when there are protests about the Yanukovych's government decision in Ukraine, who was president at the time, to basically pull out of talks with the EU and really turn toward Moscow. And there were huge protests that broke out across Ukraine that were known as the Euromaidan protests, and in particularly in Kiev. And those forced Yanukovych ultimately out of power. And shortly after that, we get both uprisings in eastern Ukraine, but also a grab of buildings and things in Crimea, and then Russian military forces themselves actually entering into Crimea to get control of that particular region of Ukraine, and then further sparked uprisings with Russian assistance in two eastern regions of Ukraine called Donetsk and Luhansk. So these are far eastern regions of Ukraine that border Russia. So Russia has had pro-Russian separatists in control of areas and has had its own troops in place both there and really has full control of Crimea now since 2014. And so the Ukrainian government obviously has a great interest in getting military aid to help defend itself, with Ukraine still fighting occasionally these battles over these areas of Ukraine. But also I think there's an interesting question that President Trump raised, which is whether Zelensky's election as the new president of Ukraine may open a door toward slightly better relations potentially between Ukraine and Russia, although Zelensky has made very clear he has no interest in accepting the idea that Crimea is now a part of Russia and, in fact, would like close relationships with Europe as well.
And you were starting to touch on this. Talk about how important American assistance, military or otherwise, is to a new president of Ukraine.
Well, it's very important both in terms of the actual weapons themselves. The phone call, President Zelensky specifically mentioned these Javelin weapons that essentially are anti-tank shoulder-held rockets. And those are very important because Russian tank attacks in the Far East would be something that Ukraine would have to be worrying about. But I think it's also important symbolically. So beyond the actual weapons, the fact that the U.S. is willing to support Ukraine's struggle to maintain independence from Russia, I think is seen domestically as something that Zelensky would really want to be able to show the Ukrainian people, that he has this relationship with the U.S. that would allow American support to come in to help defend Ukraine.
Now, bringing things back home a little bit now, we've got the content of the call, much of which we've seen in this memo about the call between the two presidents. And we've got the whistleblower complaint. The details he gave match up pretty well with what's in this call. We're also hearing more about this idea that, okay, records of this call, electronic records of this call being stored in a more highly secure security system than they might be. It sounds like the White House is saying, yeah, we are doing that. How important is that piece of the story?
Well, it's important both because it's odd. I mean, this is not the normal way that a telephone transcript between the American president and another foreign leader would be handled. And the particular level of security clearance that that server had for people meant that a very limited number of people could actually ever get to those documents in that kind of server. And it's really meant for things when we're, I mean, it's really the level of things when you're talking about plans of potentially, overthrowing a leader abroad kind of thing, right? It's things you really want to protect from a large number of eyes. And so the thought is that was done really as a way of just trying to bury the transcript so it couldn't be seen widely within the intelligence community or within the White House. And I think in terms of the Democrats' investigations, part of that would also symbolize a kind of sense of guilt about the conversation, right? That if the conversation was totally innocent and there's nothing wrong with it, why is the transcript being buried in this particular way to try to hide it?
Talking to Lowell Barrington from Marquette University, looking at the latest twists and turns in the impeachment inquiry targeting President Trump and communications between the president of the United States and that of Ukraine. Lowell, let's turn to the role. We haven't talked about this much on the show of former New York Mayor Rudolph Giuliani, personal lawyer now for President Trump, and heavily involved in the story and talking a lot about it in the media. What do you make of his presence here?
Well, he hasn't been helping the president in certain ways. And I think one of the things as we're going to the conversation here today, there's the breaking news about subpoenas now that the congressional committees have issued, including for Mike Pompeo. And Pompeo's piece of this is largely because Giuliani has claimed now on television that what he was doing in Ukraine, he was told to do by the State Department. So whether that's true or not, I don't know, but it clearly then opens the door to someone like Pompeo having to try to explain the State Department's role in this and really try to clarify whether Giuliani is actually being accurate with that statement, in which case there are problems. Or if he's not accurate, of course, that creates additional different problems for Giuliani and for President Trump.
We haven't done impeachments a lot here in the United States or tried to that much. That said, how does a current, say, House Speaker and people work on impeachment, what do they do? What kind of strategies, what kind of tactics do you see them using as this develops?
Well, one of the big questions that they have is how quickly do they want to do this? So one of the things I was a bit surprised by was hearing the Democrats essentially almost put out a timetable for this, that they want to have it wrapped up in the late fall. And that's awkward because it shows maybe that you're not willing to follow everything until the end of it before you decide on an article of impeachment. But it also it creates problems if they do uncover new things and how long it then ends up dragging out. So that was a bit of a surprise. The other question I think that we want to think about is, I mean, I think there are going to be articles of impeachment. I think there's no question at this point. And I think ultimately they're going to come out of the House and there will be a case brought before the Senate and the Senate will have to vote on this. But one of the strategic questions is how many articles of impeachment? And I think the Democrats are smartly in some ways, I guess, zeroing in on this topic, not because it's the only big issue, but it resonates with people. People can kind of understand this idea of somebody who appears that they were kind of shaken down by a more powerful individual for assistance and things. And so I think that it does make some sense. I would be surprised, though, if there aren't multiple levels or multiple actual acts and articles of impeachment, in that you want to give Republicans an out to maybe vote on one but vote against other ones. So if you have only one, it's just an up or down vote on that one article of impeachment. And if you give them two or three, maybe they can say, well, we voted against two of them, but we really had to vote in favor of this one. So I guess I'm still thinking it would make sense we'd see two or three different articles of impeachment. But one of them will certainly be this kind of abuse of power for personal gain, one that will be related to U.S. foreign policy and Ukraine in particular.
Now, what else are you watching for as this starts to unfold, apart from what exactly the Democrats choose to pursue in the House?
I think one of the big questions is just how many of the claims that are in the whistleblower complaint that we don't have verification of, how many of those end up being supported. So, as you said, in fact, there's a lot already that's been backed up in the whistleblower complaint, either from the transcript of the phone conversation or from the White House themselves actually admitting to things that were in the complaint. But there's some other things that have not been followed yet. And one of the real interesting parts for me was kind of at the end of the whistleblower complaint, there's a statement about the whistleblower having heard from multiple people that this was not the first time that the administration had sort of buried a presidential transcript in this code word level system. And that's something Congress, I think, would be very interested in following up on. Right? Are there other examples of the Ukraine case so that while the Ukraine case becomes the kind of featured example, it can be put in the context of a pattern of behavior that goes beyond just Ukraine?
Yeah, we've seen the Russian government in particular say, yes, we would prefer not to have something like this happened to one of our transcripts, one of Putin's transcripts with Trump, as just happened with this conversation with the Ukrainian president.
Well, and this is a real serious question here. The transcript's out now. I mean, the genie's out of the bottle and the whistleblower complaint is out. Mike McFaul, who I really respect a lot, he's a Russian analyst that served in the U.S. government for a long time, including in the Obama administration. He was making a kind of desperate plea the day before the phone transcript was released to have it not be released. And he's no friend of President Trump. He's been very critical. But he said as a official working in these kinds of situations where he's either in the room on the phone call or working with the NSC as they're interpreting the phone call and things like that, he said it's really hard to conduct telephone diplomacy in the future if foreign leaders have to worry that things that they say are going to end up in the American media. And so I think that is something we have to think about, that while there are positives about the events the last few days in terms of transparency, and we know things we wouldn't know, this will pose challenges for either President Trump or future presidents in conducting relationships without being face-to-face with people, because there will be this fear of the phone call transcript perhaps being released in the future as well.
Lowell, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Sure, Rob. Thank you.
That's Lowell Barrington, Associate Professor and Chair of the Political Science Department at Marquette University, talking about all the things going on in national politics right now, an impeachment inquiry, and more.